WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Alfred Hitchcock's 1958 masterpiece, Vertigo, has just been restored in 70mm with Dolby Sound. The movie stars James Stewart as a cop who develops vertigo after falling from a roof while chasing a suspect. While he recovers, he's hired by an old friend to do some detective work. The friend says his wife thinks she's possessed by a spirit, and he fears she'll kill herself. Stewart is mesmerized by this haunted beauty, played by Kim Novak. She sees frightening visions.
There's a room, and I sit there alone, always alone.
What else?
Grave.
Where?
I don't know. It's an open grave, and I stand by the gravestone looking down into it. It's my grave.
But how do you know?
I know.
But is there a name on the gravestone?
No, it's new and clean and waiting.
What else?
This part is dream, I think. There's a tower and a bell in a garden below. It seems to be in Spain. Village in Spain. It clicks off and it's gone.
Well, a portrait. Do you see a portrait?
No.
If I could just find the key, the beginning, and put it together.
So explain it away. There is a way to explain it, you see. If I'm mad, then that would explain it, wouldn't it?
Madeline!
Vertigo is restored by my guests Robert Harris and James Katz, who also restored Spartacus, Lawrence of Arabia, and My Fair Lady. Katz was president of Universal Pictures' Classics Division in the early 80s when they re-released five Hitchcock films, including Vertigo. That's when he realized what bad shape Vertigo was in. I asked him why he and Harris decided to restore it.
It's one of the most important American films ever made. It's considered one of Hitchcock's masterpieces. And it was a large format film, which is something that Bob and I specialize in. And we thought there was an audience out there again for this, because a whole generation plus has passed and without seeing these films on the big screen.
So what was the state of Vertigo when you decided to restore it?
Well, when we opened the cans, we found that the camera negative was very faded, extremely faded in some areas, very faded in others. The black and white separations, which protect the negative, were shrunken, and they weren't made terribly well. And the sound elements were basically gone. They had all been junked in 1967. And everything in sound went back to a 1958 optical print. The only interesting thing that we did find were the original Bernard Herrmann floor recordings, which had been sitting in a vault at Paramount for 38 years.
So the floor recordings are what, the original?
The original recordings, which were done in three-track stereo.
Wow, well, that must have been exciting to find.
That was a very exciting find for us.
In fact, there's a new star of this version of Vertigo, and that's the Bernard Herrmann score, because we've been able to feature it to a far greater degree than it's been in the past.
You mean you mixed it in differently than it had been in the past?
It's a totally new mix. We had to. In order to use the music, we had to derive what would be a dialogue stem from this 1958 optical unit, which was not terribly great quality. Dialogue elements were digitized, removed, and when you do that, you lose all of your Foley, which are body sounds, touching cloth, movement, things like that.
Footsteps, car door
right,
slamming.
Right, that's car door slamming, those are sound effects. Foley is basically the body sounds.
Right, okay.
So we lost the Foley, lost the effects, and then had to go back and create all new stereo Foley, all new stereo effects, and mix those in with the stereo music and the clean dialogue.
You'll hear this and see this film in a way that Hitchcock never saw it or heard it.
Well, gee, I'm not sure if I have mixed feelings about that or not. You know, when I see a restoration, I suppose part of me wants to be convinced this is exactly how it looked when it was first made. This is exactly what Hitchcock wanted.
Well, he actually, we also have Madonna doing a song over the main title track. Which
see, you're really selling out.
Now, this is a big, there's an ethical question here, and it's something that we're confronted with on a regular basis. You know, when we were doing Spartacus, we had Stanley Kubrick to speak to and Kirk Douglas, who was the producer. On My Fair Lady, we had to make judgments all the time, and on Vertigo, every day was a decision. Once we knew that we wanted to use the original sound recordings, we knew there would be fallout. We knew that we would be doing a new Foley and effects track, but we used the original track from another print as a map, and we followed each sound and each effect very, very carefully.
We also had all of Hitchcock's dubbing notes, which survive. We do a great deal of research. We'll do research for 3 or 4 or 5 months sometimes to get every piece of paper, anything that we could possibly find that can be useful. And on this picture, very fortunately, we had all of the daily continuity reports, all of the camera reports, and lastly, and possibly most importantly for the track, Hitchcock's original dubbing notes with all of his thoughts on them, on how every sound effect should be handled.
Tell us something interesting from those dubbing notes that helped guide you.
Well, one thing we had was we knew that Hitchcock's philosophy was pretty much less is more. And whenever there was a temptation to do something or add something, we really thought carefully about it. And the interesting thing was that in 1957-58, they would have to conceptualize a reel before they were able to actually make a pass at it in the dubbing theater. They didn't have what we call rock and roll, where you can go back and forth now and correct even a scene, a line.
A frame.
A frame of film can be corrected now. So they would conceptualize the reel and give not only the specifics, but they would try and describe the effect that they wanted that reel to have in relation to the picture as a whole. And all of these notes were very specific in that to that extent. And we also had Hitchcock's producer, who was called associate producer, Herbert Coleman, who's now 89 years old and lives in Salinas, California. And we would call him and ask him about the various nuances, and he was very much involved in that, and it was a tremendous help to us, as were many people from the original production.
Yeah, we really did have a brain trust of production personnel.
How would Hitchcock describe in his dubbing notes the effect that he wanted the music to have?
For example, there's a sequence in the film where Jimmy is following Kim around San Francisco, and at one point she enters the McKittrick Hotel, and you see her go upstairs. You don't see her go upstairs, but you see her open a window upstairs. Jimmy follows her in and looks up to a very ornate wooden ceiling and hears off-screen, yes, and the yes is coming from Ellen Corby, who's the, as she's called, the manageress of the hotel, and it causes him to look down to see her. And you then cut to the desk, and in 35 millimeter prints, you couldn't see it, but in 70, you can see her lips moving, doing a silent yes. So this was actually originally production dialogue. Hitchcock moved it up so that it was off screen, and it is the cause of Jimmy Stewart looking down. Now, the fellows on the boards did it two ways for us. They synced the yes up and made it production dialogue again, and then said, well, we can actually make this better in quotes, by using a paper shuffle or a drawer slam or something that will, an effect that will cause him to look down, and then we'll have the dialogue in the place that it would have been. But the decision was made very simply to not do that, because Hitchcock made this decision in 1958, and we don't have the right, we don't have the moral right to change things of that sort. We have an obligation to keep things as pure as possible. Another interesting point is that when you work on a picture that's 38 or 40 or 45 years old, whatever these pictures happen to be, you're dealing with an old optical soundtrack. And these tracks have hisses and pops and dead space in them, which you could not hear through the reproduction equipment of the 1950s. Today, they stand out like a sore thumb. They really become horrific on modern equipment. So we have to add nuances like room tone or a very, very subtle effect to fill things in and to give it a little body, because to play back an optical copy of a 1958 track really does an injustice to the film.
Every defect becomes magnified.
Oh,
every stray sound.
It's extremely magnified. There's one couple of things in My Fair Lady. You can actually hear a fly buzzing around the set, moving from left to right in one scene. As Rex Harrison sits down in one of his overstuffed chairs, he was body mic'd. You can hear as the cushions give way. We had major problems with him because he was live mic'd. All of his songs were recorded live. They were extremely strident. It was the first time that a radio microphone was used, and they had constant problems. They were picking up the local police departments as he was singing occasionally.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Robert Harris and Jim Katz, and they've just restored the Alfred Hitchcock classic Vertigo. We'll talk more about the restoration after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Robert Harris and Jim Katz, they just restored Vertigo. They also, earlier, restored Lawrence of Arabia, Spartacus, and My Fair Lady. You consulted with a lot of the people who are still alive, who participated in the making of Vertigo. Tell me one of the more interesting stories that you were told that helped inform you in your restoration of the movie.
Well, one thing that we knew for a fact but was constantly reiterated by Herbert Coleman was that Hitchcock just didn't like to shoot on location. And there was an inordinate amount of rear screen projection in this film. And they were on a corner in San Francisco, which was by Scotty's apartment. And they had a crew out there some ungodly hour. And they were ready to shoot, and Hitchcock pulls up, which was his wont, in his limousine, and lowered the window about a quarter of the way and said to Herbie, "Why did you pick the windiest corner in San Francisco to do this? Let's do this in the studio." And most of the shots around Scotty's apartment were done with rear screen projection in the studio. But all you have to do is look at the picture and see how it works and how what a genius he was, and how every shot was, he would draw shots. We have illustrations of him, of his, that would show exactly where he wanted the camera, how, what the moves would be in his own hand.
Alfred Hitchcock very carefully chose the palette for Vertigo. What did you have to do to find out what the real true colors were, since what you were looking at wasn't true colors at all? You were looking at faded, messed up
There are two things. Number one, there were Technicolor prints, which one would think would be a reference, but since they're made with different types of dyes and they don't fade, they gave us a reasonable reference. But for example, one of the dresses that Kim wears in a scene comes out as sort of a cyanish green. And we would basically do everything that we could to find examples. Jim spent a lot of time looking for a color chip, which I think we can let him tell you about.
Madeline, the character Kim Novak plays, drove a green Jaguar, or as I found out in my studies, Jaguar. And we tried to get the company in Coventry, England, to send us the paint chips from that year. So at least we had a basis for the color reference on the car, and the costume that we had of Kim's was the green costume Judy, where she's in the hotel room toward the end of the film. The costume has a polka dot collar, and that was faded as well. But at least it gave us a ballpark. It gave us some idea of what we were looking for in these colors that were not heavy primary colors. And there are any number of instances throughout the film where we would try to at least get some idea. We found one of the discarded portraits of Carlotta, and that gave us a bit of a hint into what the bouquet looked like.
Now, here's what you got to tell me about. I read that you found an alternate ending to the film. I think the studio asked Hitchcock to try it out this way. So I'm dying to hear about this.
It's an extended ending, really. It's not an alternate ending. Uh-huh. And this is something that we're really very anxious to emphasize. The ending was basically required to satisfy censorship in countries abroad and in the French Canadian provinces. And after the really dramatic ending of Jimmy Stewart looking down...
Wait, for people who haven't seen the movie, you turn out for a second, and then maybe the rest of us can hear what you have to say, because I really want to hear this, without destroying it for anybody else. Go ahead.
Well, the ending, as we all know and love it, is a very dramatic shot of Jimmy Stewart standing on the precipice of... the tower at San Juan Batista. What happens is it fades out, and we fade into Midge's apartment, and Barbara Bel Geddes, who plays Midge, is sitting by a radio, and she is listening to a reporter saying that Gavin Elster has been spotted in Paris, and they do not see any reason why they should not apprehend him shortly, or words to that effect. Jimmy Stewart comes into the apartment. She clicks off the radio when she hears him, gets up and mixes him a drink and walks over to the big window overlooking San Francisco, hands him the drink, and they look at each other and we fade out. So basically we're telling the audience that the bad guy has been caught.
Right. Gavin Ulster is the guy who frames Jimmy Stewart.
Right. Right.
What would censors want with that ending?
Well, there are just countries that require. There are countries that find it necessary to make sure that the bad guy is caught and is punished. And this is, they can't get away. And in the version that everybody knows, we never hear much more about Gavin Elster. And in this case, we know that everything's been resolved, but the bad guy's also been caught, so we've tied it all up into a neat package. But it takes so much away from the ending of the film, the drama of the end of the picture, that it was ridiculous that it was even shot. And you know that Hitchcock did it grudgingly, and
right.
Even at this point, the family has asked us not to release this in any way, in which we're happy to honor.
Did Hitchcock write anything about that in his notes?
He said it wouldn't be shown
over his dead body.
Which is sort of, there's a macabre humor in that somewhere.
So we're trying not to show. We certainly don't want to run it theatrically.
Right, right. I'm sure you still have questions that you'd love to hear Hitchcock answer. What question would you most like to have been able to ask Hitchcock about Vertigo?
Why he did certain things in certain ways, the concept behind coming up with the area where the camera and Jimmy and Kim turn, which makes it appear that the set is changing. I'd love to know how he came up with some of those ideas. I mean, we're dealing really with one of the most brilliant filmmakers that ever lived. A great showman, but he had a sense of style and a sense of taste that I think in many ways were incomparable. And his technical prowess was extraordinary. And when you see some of these things, you often wonder, what is it? You know, how would he get these ideas?
Well, thanks for restoring movies I want to see.
You're welcome.
And thanks for being with us.
Our pleasure.
Robert Harris and James Katz restored the 1958 Alfred Hitchcock film Vertigo. The new Dolby soundtrack will soon be out on CD. In the meantime, you can hear the suite from Vertigo on a new Los Angeles Philharmonic album of Bernard Herrmann's film scores. This is Fresh Air.